From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Greg Allman made music right up until his death last year.
I thank God for the longevity of my career.
It's Greg Allman on this show in 2015. Today we'll listen to his final album, Southern Blood. It's up for a Grammy Award later this month. First, though, we talked to Tim Renick of Georgia State University about how college admissions can actually drive income inequality.
And Georgia State's now graduating more black students than any other college or university in the United States.
Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, my name is G, and I'm calling from Atlanta, Georgia. I wanted to know if that included HBCUs, and if so, how did they get those ranks? How did they get those numbers?
Well, Tim Renick says Georgia State conferred around 2,000 bachelor degrees to African Americans last year, and in 2016, more black students earned degrees at GSU than at any other nonprofit college in the U.S., including HBCUs. That's according to the study by the journal Diverse Issues in Higher Education. We always want to know what you think and answer your questions, if we can. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Or just post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Georgia's Girl Scouts recently joined the debate over a Savannah bridge name. Talmadge Memorial Bridge was built in 1991. It was named for a former governor and a segregationist. The Girl Scouts would like the bridge to be renamed in honor of their founder and Savannah native, Juliet Gordon Lowe. Today marks 91 years since Lowe's death, and joining me now to talk about her life is historian Jamie Brantley. She manages the Girl Scout First Headquarters Museum in Savannah. Hi there.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
How did she come to found the Girl Scouts?
I always say that Juliet essentially had a what we'd call today a midlife crisis. She was...
Wait, what was midlife for her?
She was around 40 or so at the time that she started sort of examining her life. And at that point in time, her marriage had dissolved. Essentially, she was in the process of divorcing her husband, which was almost unheard of at that time, especially for someone in her social status. And also, she had no children. And, of course, at that time period, those were the two, you know, benchmarks by which a woman measured her success was, you know, a happy home and her children. And she had neither. So she looked around for different things to kind of fulfill herself. She traveled and she took up art and so forth. And then within a few years, she actually met the gentleman who founded the Boy Scout movement. Lord Robert Baden-Powell, and it was very shortly after the Boy Scout movement, and he basically, they hit it off. They had so many things in common, and she fell in love with the idea of the Girl Guide movement, our sister organization in England, which had also just started. And so she started looking around at how she could make a difference for these girls, how they could have more options than she had, how they could define success in their life, basically, so they could have everyday life skills, but also if they ever needed to support themselves, they would have a way to do so, and also just a way to have fun and get outside of their comfort zones and experience something new.
For point of context, I just want to let everyone know that Girl Scouts were founded in 1912, just past their 100-year anniversary. So when you talk about the era that in which they were founded, that's what we're talking about. She had really sort of a definitive idea of what kind of girl she thought a Girl Scout should be. And we actually asked a group of Girl Scouts in coastal Georgia to tell us what they think makes a good leader. So here are some of the responses that they recorded themselves.
Hi, my name is Haley Jackson from Richmond Hill, Georgia. I'm in 10th grade and I'm a Girl Scout senior. And I believe what makes a good leader is determination to handle the obstacles and be prepared to handle anything that gets thrown at them. Because a good leader should be determined no matter what the outcome may be.
My name is Sahara Howard. I am 15 years old and a senior Girl Scout. A leader shouldn't be afraid to fail. And if they do, they must have the confidence to learn from their mistakes and get back up and try again.
So that's what current Girl Scouts think. But Juliet Gordon Lowe was, raised in a pretty high class family. She was ladylike by any measure of the word. What did she think of as sort of the ideal scout?
She wanted the girls to be scouts. She wanted them to go out and find things about which they were passionate about. She also wanted them to look around their community and see how they could, you know, improve their community. So she wanted the girls to improve their individual lives, but then she also wanted them to work together and be leaders for the community and improve the communities and of course, our country as a whole.
So let's hear one more time before we go back to Juliet Gordon-Lowe and her vision of the Scouts. Let's go back to the Girl Scouts of Coastal Georgia and hear what they say about being a leader.
Hi, my name is Alex, and I live in Savannah, Georgia. I'm a senior in high school, and this is my 12th year as a Girl Scout. To me, a leader is someone who is unafraid to take on the task of making change.
My name is Sydney, and I am currently a senior Girl Scout in my 11th year of scouting. A leader has to be brave enough to face any hardships or troubles that might come their way, because no matter what, a leader has to stand strong for all those following them.
Did Low, and when the Girl Scouts first started, it was, we're just talking about 18 girls, right? I mean, it was a small group.
Right. She reached out to some of her connections in Savannah and said, this is what I want to do. They actually pulled together the first meeting in 3 days.
Wow.
Exactly. So they had 18 girls, and these girls were from such a cross-section of the Savannah community. There were girls of different religions, Protestant, Catholic, Jewish girls. There were girls from different economic classes in Savannah as well. You had very wealthy girls and girls also from basically the lower stratus in the society as well.
We're going to talk about inclusivity in a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jamie Brantley, a historian with the Girl Scouts of Georgia. We're talking about the push to rename Talmadge Bridge for the founder of the Girl Scouts, Juliet Gordon-Lowe. I was not a Girl Scout. Were you a Girl Scout growing up?
I actually wasn't. I don't believe we actually had Girl Scouts in my town, which is slightly ironic in Georgia. But very quickly, I've always respected Girl Scouts, as most Georgians do, and kind of what the Girl Scouts do for their communities. But it was later on that I became involved as a volunteer first and then as a staff member.
Yeah, I was an Indian maiden. But it looks like inclusivity, which the Girl Scouts are quite known for in modern times, especially as compared with the Boy Scouts who've struggled with this particular issue. This was part of the founding principles of Juliet Gordon-Lowe, was it not?
Absolutely. She actually, you know, she was very clear from the beginning that she wanted Girl Scouting to be for every girl. She even experienced some pushback from some of her own family members. Are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. But she was also very savvy. She realized that that was not going to necessarily go over very well in every community. So she essentially left it up to what we would today call councils. So basically the local groups of Girl Scouts to decide to whom they would extend membership. And so it would vary from area to area. So in some areas you would find maybe, as I said, in Savannah, Jewish girls were absolutely part of the early scouting movement, but maybe not in another community. Also in another community there might be more ethnic groups represented as opposed to another community. But very quickly, because Girl Scouting was so good about, you know, if you're going to be part of this movement and you're going to say our promise and you're going to live by our laws, you have to really live that. And so the membership very quickly expanded to include basically any demographic of girl that you could imagine.
And where the group was integrated before the public schools, you've said.
Absolutely. In the South especially, in larger cities, northern cities, integration happened much more quickly. But in the South, we were much ahead of the curve by the 1930s and 40s for the most part. And even by the 1950s, Dr. King called Girl Scouts a force for desegregation, which is something of which we've always been very proud.
She herself was a colorful character, right? I mean, you tell the story about her showing off her new shoes. What would she do?
Oh, absolutely. Juliet had such charisma, and she was so energetic and enthusiastic. She would basically almost use that as a recruitment tool for both girls and volunteers. When there was a new pair of Girl Scout shoes, they had official Girl Scout shoes, she wore them to a meeting, and someone said, oh, are those the new Girl Scout shoes? And she said, sure. And they said, can we see them? So her solution to that was so that everyone could see them more clearly was she tucked her skirt in between her knees and did a handstand, which is something we all do when we show off our shoes. Oh,
absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Yes.
So what do you make of this push to rename Talmadge Bridge in honor of Juliet Gordon-Lowe? First of all, what would the bridge then be called? Lowe Bridge?
I'm assuming the Juliet Gordon-Lowe Memorial Bridge. That would be up to the state, and that would be their decision. Girl Scouts did not start this conversation. This was started by a group of concerned citizens in Savannah and leadership and so forth. But we said that if the change is going to happen, we would love to have it even be considered to be named after Juliet, because she was such a bridge builder herself. She was As you mentioned, she was from a very affluent, conservative Southern family, but she looked to the future. She took the best parts of her childhood and her upbringing, and she decided she wanted to make things better. And so that's how we have this opportunity in Girl Scouting today. And then also, we look at this as an opportunity in the bridge naming process as an opportunity to teach our Girl Scouts about advocacy, about how to approach your representatives, how to affect change in your community or in your state. So if nothing else, this is absolutely an educational and empowering tool for our girls.
Do you think that Juliet Gordon Lowe was a product of Savannah itself? In other words, do the Girl Scouts organization, especially in their founding, reflect the place where the organization was founded?
I believe so. Savannah, even today, if you have a chance to visit, it's a small town. It has that small town feel where you know everyone. So even if someone is different from you, they're still your neighbors. It's still part of your community. You have to find the similarities rather than focusing on the differences. And we do have such diversity in Savannah. You know, it makes it interesting, and there's always opportunities to learn more and expand yourself. And so those are fundamental principles of the Girl Scouts.
I have to say, I had no idea before this effort, which, as you say, was not a Girl Scout effort to rename the bridge, but Juliet Gordon Lowe's name has been posited. I didn't know the Girl Scouts were founded in Savannah. Why do you think, for many people outside the city itself, that history is unknown?
I'm honestly not sure. Juliet Lowe, as we were discussing earlier, was so involved with the Girl Guide movement when it was first formed. She came back to Savannah, which was home for her. She had the resources here to get started. So I think that was a very, you know, savvy move on her part to, you know, go to her cousin who was the principal of a school. Obviously, that was a great resource for her. And she was basically, her family was so well respected in Savannah, it made it easier for her to start this organization, which could have been seen as a little bit, you know, a little bit liberal or a little
reformist. Look at the record,
absolutely.
It was seen that way.
Absolutely. But because her family was so well respected, and she was as well, and she was actually fairly conservative, you know, that it was, had anyone else tried to do this, I don't think it would have worked. But then she also parlayed her relationships from Savannah. For instance, Mrs. Woodrow Wilson, she, you know, gained an introduction to her. And so from Savannah, the move was made to Washington for our headquarters. And then eventually from Washington, you know, she worked her connections basically and wound up with some of the leading women of the time, some of the reformers and so forth, to support the movement. Absolutely.
And Girl Scouts have collected about 10,000 signatures to support the effort to rename the bridge after their founder. And there will be an event on February 6th to voice that support. Jamie Brantley, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Jamie is a historian with the Girl Scouts of Georgia. Just ahead, the unmistakable sound of the true Georgia accent. First, though, Greg Allman may win a posthumous Grammy Award. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Hearts broke in Georgia and across the world when Greg Allman died in May of last year at his home in Savannah. But Greg left a part of his legacy behind. In the years leading up to his death, Greg and his band worked on an album at Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. That's where the shoots of the Allman Brothers Band first sprouted in the 1960s. It's called Southern Blood, and the album is mostly new material. It came out last year, and it's now up for a Grammy Award this month. Legendary music producer Don Was worked closely with Greg on the album, and producer Trevor Young caught up with him.
Hello, my name is Don Was. I'm a record producer, musician. There are a myriad of emotions I experienced making this record. There's clearly an air of gravitas around what we're doing. knowing that he probably wasn't going to be around to do interviews like this. We also had a really good time. He always wanted to make a record with his touring band that he put together. He was really proud of that band. There's a sound he always heard in his head that he felt he never got on records before. That made that my mission, to help him achieve that sound. And we were getting it, and he was really happy about it.
Suddenly, out of left field, out of left field.
I could tell as we started choosing songs, he was gravitating towards songs that had some relevance to what was going on in his life. It seemed as though there was a kind of a theme emerging of Greg tying up the loose ends in his life. I think he did that. It was therapeutic for himself, as well as something that I think he really wanted to do for the fans who stuck with him for decades. Probably the most direct song on the album is what I view as really a kind of a confessional piece that Greg wrote along with his guitar player, Scott Sherrard. Opens the record. It's called My Only True Friend. And it begins with the lines, "You and I both know this river will surely come to an end.
You and I both know this river will surely flow to an end. Keep me in your heart. Keep your soul."
The thing that really struck me was that he was great in the studio. I like to sit out in the room with the musicians, and so I've seated about 10 feet away from him. And I was just blown away by, you know, what a great singer he was and how he really threw himself into the vocals. The vocals you hear on this album are pretty much live vocals.
I can't face living this life alone. I can't bear to think this might be the end.
I listened to this record a lot. To be honest with you, I don't really play the records that I produced that much for recreation later. You know, I've been wanting to play this record, and I found some comfort in it. I guess because I feel as long as the music's playing, he's still here.
Another night alone, but I see you in my dreams sometimes. No matter where I go, Lord knows you were always on my mind.
Don was producer on Greg Allman's posthumous record, Southern Blood. My colleague Adam Ragusea talked about the record and Greg's legacy with one of his closest lifetime friends, Cenk Middleton. He also talked with Scott Sherrard, Greg's guitarist and band manager.
Hey, how's it going?
Scott, what's up, bro?
Cenk.
Gentlemen, before we start talking about the record, I wonder if you couldn't both just tell us briefly about how you came to know Greg Allman. Cenk?
I met him in 1969 when they first moved to Macon. I was shining shoes in the barbershop next door to the studio. The studio didn't have air conditioning at that point, and they didn't have a drink machine. But right next door, we had air conditioning and a drink machine. So when they took a break from rehearsing, they would come over to the barbershop to cool off and get something to drink. And they wasn't getting haircuts, so they would all gather around the shoe shine stand with me, and I would shine their shoes, you know.
And how about you, Scott?
Well, I was raised on the music of the Allman Brothers, so I saw my first Allman Brothers concert when I was about 10 or 11 years old, and never looked back. And then I met Greg personally in about 2008 when I auditioned for his band by sitting in with the Allman Brothers.
That's great. Let's talk about the new record, Southern Blood, and let's listen to another clip before we do that. This is from a song called Once I Was.
Sometimes I wonder just for a while, do you ever
there's just so many songs on this record, guys, that seem either directly or obliquely to be about the coming of death. When Greg Allman's death was announced, it was a shock to a lot of people. You know, people knew that he had been ill for some time, but no one knew that he was seriously ill. Did he know that he was dying as he made this record, Cenk?
At this point, he did. I tell everybody, he was the person, I never heard him complain about anything. Oh, for the past 6 years, you know, they got diagnosed like, what, 6.5 years ago with it. And from his first time he was diagnosed, he never did complain. He never did even talk about it. Yeah. So when he recorded the album, to me, it was just like any other album he recorded. You know, the songs were good, everything was good. But after he passed and I heard it, it took on that same meaning to me that everybody else seeing in it now.
Yeah.
You know, he knew it was coming, but he didn't tell us. He didn't share it with us. He just bowed out gracefully. That's what he did.
Scott, when you were making it, did you know that it was either intentionally or maybe just by proximity going to be a goodbye album?
Yeah, I mean, there were only a few of us who knew about his diagnosis, and we all knew that he was kind of beating the clock. I myself was sort of in denial because he had so much power when he would perform, and I watched him suffer so much in the time I worked with him with the different complications from his ailments. But every time he got on stage, he would transform into a lion.
It
was no different in the studio. Plus, he was so happy with our band. And, like, you know, we had so many laughs. And I know, I mean, it probably to people who are listening to the record now in light of Greg's passing and everything, I mean, it would seem like we were all being serious. But with music, you know, great music is something that happens on the way to getting your next barbecue meal. It's not something you really think about. You know what I mean? Just
yes,
have a good time and you hang out and you feel it together. And when a group really gels, that was our ace in the hole. And that was what Greg would tell me all the time. Those aren't my words, you know, in terms of, you know, this was his favorite band. And in terms of our live band.
It was. That we had. God, you were. Whew.
Yeah. So we just had a good time, man. And it's interesting because the record is heavy and intense. But we really had a wonderful time playing music together.
We're talking about Greg Allman's new posthumously released record, Southern Blood, and I'm joined in GPB's Macon studio right now by Cenk Middleton, lifelong friend of Greg Allman, and also Scott Sherrard, who was Greg Allman's guitarist and band manager and worked extensively on the album, as you can hear. Let's listen to some more music. This is Black Muddy River.
When I can't hear the song for the singer, I can't tell my pillow from a stone. I will walk along by the black muddy river. Sing me a song.
It strikes me as we listen to this album that his voice does sound physically weary, right? But on the other hand, he sounded like that when he was 20. He's
You're
always
right.
sounded like an
always
old man.
Always sounded like that. You're right. Yeah.
Where did he get that from? He always sounded like this wizened old fellow.
He just had that power to, when he always said, I put it like this, he had a sciatic. He pulled a sciatic like 8 or 9 years ago.
So it gave him pain in his leg and his back?
He had real bad pain, but he went out every night and performed. But he would use a walking stick to get to the stage. But he wouldn't walk out on stage with the walking stick. But once he sat out behind that organ, I mean, it was like he was brand new, okay?
Scott, did he have physical trouble in the studio on this record?
Not that I noticed.
Not
but again, you know, he would mask it by performing it. You wouldn't know, so it was hard to tell sometimes.
True.
Did he complete the record before his death, or did you guys have more work that you needed to do on it after he passed?
Well, we had a lot of ideas for this record. There were a lot of challenges in just getting to the studio to make this record, various challenges. His health, he really loved to perform live, so we were doing a lot of gigs for somebody who was struggling like he was. And then on top of it all, just keeping the whole operation going and the state of the music business the way it is now, it was very challenging. But I think that we had a lot of plans and a lot of cool ideas for this record. And what ended up happening is we ended up making, I think, his goodbye letter to his family, friends, and fans. Music's funny like that. You can try to, or any creative art for that matter, you think you could plan it out as a group, but it leads you. You don't lead it in the end,
True. Yeah.
Sure. But was it finished at the time of his death, or was there more, mixing or more tracking that had to be done to it after he died?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was driving at. There were things that we all wanted to do. There were some tracks that actually didn't make the record. There was another song Greg and I wrote that we didn't have time to record. Huh.
Do you think that'll ever see the light of day?
Yeah, it's going to be on my record that's coming out next year as a bonus track.
That's great.
Basically there were various things there was a song called Pack It Up that we recorded that Greg never got the chance to put any vocals on. There were some loose ends, but in the end there are no loose ends. I mean, that's really, I'm not going to ruin it for anybody by telling them how we made the sausage. It tastes delicious. It is what it is. it is what it is, man. It's a beautiful documentation of this man's last lap, and I think it's his best record since Laid Back.
I agree with you, Scott, and we can also really thank Don Walls for bringing it where it is right now, okay?
Absolutely.
Because he did an incredible job on his mixing and stuff. He really did.
Let's listen to another track.
Go ahead. Bob Clearmountain mixed it as well with Don. Okay. I didn't know that actually, check, until I saw him in L.A. A couple weeks ago when I saw Don. We were just talking about the mixes, and he had told me that Bob had worked with him on it. Don was the linchpin in it all together in the end. That's what he does.
Let's listen to some more music off of Greg Allman's final record, his posthumously released album, Southern Blood. This is a tune called Blind Bats and Swamp Rats.
Blind bats, swamp rats, getting down in Mississippi bottoms, singing Como se va, the jury's out, if you lose, the justice we got.
Great stuff. Chank, how did Greg Allman toward the end of his life feel about his early work, his stuff with the Allman Brothers, the stuff for which he will always be most remembered? Was he pleased with that legacy, or did he sort of wish people paid more attention to his late career work?
Well, he was very pleased with the Allman Brothers stuff, but he also, if you look back at he'd been singing when the Allman Brothers left the road, he always had a solo band. Mm-hmm. Gregory was the type of person that he had to work all the time. He couldn't take a lot of time off from work. And that's the way it was with his, ever since I've known him. Solo band, Allman Brothers. That's why you tell a lot of people that when we entered the Allman Brothers tour, everybody was saying, well, we can go chill out. And I would tell them, y'all can go chill out, but I ain't going to chill out because we're going right back on the road with this solo band. So I didn't get a break,
Scott, was that your impression as well?
Oh, yeah. Greg lived to perform, and be on the road. And, you know, he was also, Greg was like a real musician, you know. Don't be fooled by any of this rock star stuff that, you know, people sometimes put that on people who play, you know, popular music, that they're not, you know, maybe they're not a serious musician, or they're, you know, they're into the celebrity. I mean, Greg Allman was like any of the, you know, when I was a young kid, I worked with a lot of really incredible older musicians who played blues and jazz and stuff. And he was like that, you know. It was like hanging out with the real guys. There was a real depth to the experience. And he was a musician. That's why he was on the road all the time. Yeah. He was a real musician.
That's Scott Sherrard, Greg Allman's guitarist and band manager. We've also been talking to Chank Middleton, one of Greg Allman's oldest friends, and we've been talking about his final posthumously released album, Southern Blood. Gentlemen, thank you guys so much for being here.
Yes, no problem. Glad to be
here. Thanks for having us, buddy.
Southern Blood is up for Best Americana Album at the Grammy Awards. You can watch Sunday, January 28th at 7:30 p.m. Just ahead, why do actors struggle to talk Southern? What is it about the way Southerners talk? This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's On Second Thought. Let's talk about talking Southern. And that means not just the words, but the way we say them. Here's Christopher Reeve from the 1984 film The Bostonians.
Miss Terrence said in her note, this is a place you can wear your old clothes and lie on the ground. Well, I'd delight to lie on the ground. Oh, my clothes are old. I hope to be able to stay 3 or 4 weeks.
Accents are complicated. They're often intertwined with identity. So we brought in a couple of linguists to answer our questions about them. Eric Thomas teaches at North Carolina State University. Dennis Preston teaches at Oklahoma State University. That's some geographic variety for you. I asked Eric if there's any such thing as a real Southern accent.
Well, a linguist would say that it's sort of, you have a bunch of different features, and it's a matter of a person having enough of those features, although not all Southern accents have all the particular features.
I wanted to ask about the individual accents, like whether or not there's a Georgia accent. And to start off, let's play the quintessential Georgian, right? I mean, what many people think of when they think of Atlanta and Georgia. And this is the character Scarlett O'Hara, played by Vivian Leigh, in 1939's Gone with the Wind.
What do we care if we were expelled from college, Scarlett? The war's going to start any day now, so we'd have left college anyhow.
War? Isn't it exciting, Scarlett? You know those poor Yankees actually want a war?
We'll show them.
Fiddly fee. War, war, war. This war talk's spoiling all the fun at every party this spring. I get so bored I could scream.
So that, I mean, immediately you hear, war, war, war. Dennis, is that a true Georgia accent, or was that some idea of the South?
Well, I think almost all popular representations in media, film, and whatever are all representations of ideas of a South. And as Eric just suggested, there's of course no one South. And of course, the other peculiarly interesting thing is that dialects just don't care anything about state lines. So when dialects are formed, the difference between Georgia and Alabama and Georgia and South Carolina is not very important. On the other hand, the Appalachian section of Georgia in northwest Georgia is very, very different from what we call coastal Southern, the kind of stuff that you would find closer to the ocean in the southern part of the state. So, no, there's no such thing as a Georgia accent. There's just a whole bunch of Georgia accents. Education plays a role, certainly. So I hate to disappoint people in Georgia, but there's no such thing as Georgia speech, as there's no such thing as a Southern speech. There are a whole bunch of Southern dialects and a whole bunch of Georgia dialects.
Well, I don't want to use them interchangeably. Eric, can you explain the difference between a dialect and an accent?
An accent basically refers to pronunciation features, whereas a dialect refers to not just pronunciation, but also things like vocabulary and grammatical features.
The words you use, like whether you say y'all or you guys. I'm from California originally, so I say you guys, and I keep getting corrected.
Yeah, I'm from Ohio. I say you guys, too.
Well, you guys are just wrong. I'm from Louisville, and interestingly, in Louisville, we don't say y'all. We say you all. And so when I moved a little further south, then I had to do away with my two syllables and come up with the one syllable y'all.
Well, there's also efforts to preserve the Southern dialect. So there's a project called Roswell Voices in Roswell, Georgia, that collects oral histories from some of the older residents. And let's take a listen. Here is Virginia Adams, who was interviewed for this project.
Those were WPA days, and the days when you asked the government for money to do things, and it was to give people a job.
Now, that is a real accent. Let's take a listen to one more, and this is Dorsey Coleman.
And I had a water bucket sitting in the corner of the room with a dipper in it. Everybody drank out of the same dipper. I had to go to somebody's well in the neighborhood to get the water. The outhouse was down in the woods.
So, Eric, what are we hearing there? What identifies that particular accent?
Well, there are a couple of things that you could that would stand out. The first speaker, I think she said ask, something like ask.
Yeah.
That was that's one that actors don't usually pick up on. The second person said water instead of water. So having that particular pronunciation of water with a different vowel in the first syllable is the kind of thing that linguists would notice, and probably the average person might pick up on.
So what about the disappearance of the R? A lot of people have pointed, especially to Kevin Spacey, and said that getting rid of the R is kind of an outmoded way of speaking. Dennis, do people still do that?
Oh, there are still people who are, well, us linguists like to say R-less. This dropping of R is rapidly disappearing. For example, our colleague Bill LeBeau, who's most famous for his studies in New York City, noticed the increasing disappearance of R over time in New York City, and the same thing is happening now in the South. So the items that you played for us are they're excellent language preservation things, but they're pretty old-fashioned. They have a decidedly rural sound to me, although in urban areas, in generations before, people would have sounded very much like this. But just let's make sure that we know one thing. Southern speech is not disappearing. The Southern speech of two generations ago is disappearing, and what we'll get is a new Southern speech, because it's just the matter of language and dialects. The change happens all the time, and some people are happy to see change, and I think the majority of people are kind of sad to see change, because they feel that change represents a loss of values and lifestyle. But I guarantee you that 100 years from now, there'll still be a Southern speech and a Northern speech. They just won't be the same as they were 50 years ago.
And yet, Dennis, give me some guidance on how to sound more authentic. One of our listeners called in and said that the addition of the pronunciation of the H, in other words, he talks about the alcoholic beverage as wine, but then if somebody's complaining, he'll say they're whining.
Well, he's a dying breed just like me. Now, I'm a really old guy from Louisville, Kentucky, and I love to distinguish between which and which. But if you look at recent surveys, you'll see that there's just a handful of us guys left. So if you want to sound anything like a Southerner, don't go around practicing your which, because there are very, very few Southerners left who have this distinction. If you go to Scotland or Northern Ireland, that might be a good thing for you to learn. But in Atlanta, which is not going to help you at all. It used to be a very strong feature. Well, of course, it used to be a strong feature all over the United States, but very, very rapidly it died out. It actually died out in the south of England, what we think of as posh British speech. It died out there a long time before it even died out in America.
Well, what about greasy? Eric, somebody told me that I need to pronounce, instead of greasy, I need to say greasy. What about that?
That's another traditional Southern feature. Also the verb to grease or to grease goes along with it. But, it's declining not quite as fast as the WH distinction. But you hear fewer and fewer people who have the who rhyme say greasy instead of greasy.
Be careful with that one though, because I know some Northerner who tried to learn grease and greasy, which is the correct way to say it, of course, as anybody in Louisville, Kentucky will tell you. But then they overgeneralized and they thought the noun was grease too, but it's not, as any Southerner will tell you. The noun is grease. The adjective is greasy, and the verb is to grease. So be careful. Trying to learn to sound like somebody you aren't is going to get you in a big bitch of trouble.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty lousy if you said the noun is grease.
All right. Well, let's do another one, and I hate to bring you back to Scarlett O'Hara, because neither one of you seems to have a whole lot of respect for actors' accents, but what about the sometimes turning one-syllable words into two syllables, like woa? Dennis?
Well, I think there we don't get so much as a two-syllable word as we do as linguists would call this the compensation for the loss of the R. So if we have a word like war and don't do the R, then notice there's a little there that substitutes for the R. So when in all dialects, when R is lost, whether it's British English or some other variety, there's a compensation for that loss. People don't just lose R. If you say war and lose R, you get wah. And nobody says that. Actually, in Boston and some other places, there's not so much lengthening. But we do, of course, get what sound like extra syllables. But this is from the famous effect known as the drawl, where words like live can become live, and so forth,
right,
where an extra little glide is put into them, and they all, I guess you call them two syllable. But that's the thing I think that Northerners perceive more than anything else is when this glide is introduced. And Eric, in fact, has studied that drawl feature phonetically a lot, as along with a colleague of ours from Anniston, Alabama, by the name of Corky Fagan. For me, there's a big difference between art and science. So that if actors portrayed a specific person, time, place, and so forth, I think this would probably be overkill. Someone said about literary dialect writing a long time ago, if you actually wrote down a really good representation of a dialect in literature, then nobody else would read it. So the people who are authentic speakers from a certain place are always going to be dissatisfied.
Dennis Preston of Oklahoma State University and Eric Thomas of North Carolina State University. Now, before we end today, I want to look ahead, way ahead, to say 2050. What will you sound like? What will I sound like? Linguist James Harbeck explored this question in an op-ed for the website The Week. He joined us by Skype from Toronto. I began by asking him why he's so interested in the future of our speech.
I am just fascinated by the way language changes. If you start looking at the history of the English language, you discover that things that we thought have always been that way actually have changed quite a bit. And at the same time, things that we think are really new things have actually been that way for a very long time. So it's quite reasonable to wonder, what's it going to be like 35, 50, 100 years from now?
So what are the things that influence our speech that we can kind of point to and say, oh, look, that changed things? You know, I'm thinking of like I grew up in Southern California. So at some point, something came along and made people start talking like Valley Girls, like, oh, my God. So what are the things that we can point to, or you can as a researcher, and say, OK, this will influence speech?
There are a number of different things, and not all of them are easy to identify. Sometimes you have a sort of a vector from popular culture. Somebody will come up with something, say, on Saturday Night Live. It'll turn into a fad way of usually those are the slang terms and so forth. When it comes to things like changes in accent, like the Valley Girl talk, it's a lot harder to say exactly why people do that. The entire English vowel system over a period of a couple of hundred years before Shakespeare changed noticeably, so that E became I, and A became E, and A became A. And this is one of the reasons our spelling is so weird, because our vowels all changed, and we're not really sure exactly why. But a lot of these changes seem to be innovations partly driven by a need for improving status, to have an in-group that sounds a little more different, a little better from others. That's speculative, but there is some observation that seems to support that.
Well, let's give you an example of a bad accent from movies. This is Christopher Reeve in the 1984 film The Bostonians.
Miss Tarrant said in her note, this is a place you can wear your old clothes and lie on the ground. Well, I'd delight to lie on the ground. All my clothes are old. I hope to be able to stay 3 or 4 weeks.
I'm not really sure what accent he's using there. It's not a real one. But, you know, we do hear celebrities especially picking up things like British accents, right? And using those to in some way signify elevated status or maybe intellectualism. Is that a way that speech can be influenced?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. In fact, the famous R dropping that you get in New York and Boston, although it's disappearing somewhat in New York, it still persists in much of New England, came from a desire to sound more like people in England. It was originally a higher status thing. And what happened was that as the people at lower socioeconomic levels latched onto it, the people at the upper levels moved on. They said, oh, no, this doesn't sound like Americans. And these people, they sound a little too loudish. And there may have been effect also of immigrants, lower class immigrants coming in from places where they did that as a feature of their speech. And so all of a sudden you don't want to sound like those people.
Okay, so let me use a couple clips here of Brooke Shields. These are things that you pointed to in your op-ed. First, there's a clip of her during an interview in 1980. She was only 15 years old.
They don't even treat me any differently. That doesn't bother them at all. I think that the way it has affected me is that the press, usually, had given me such a hard time that it made me a stronger person.
And here is Brooke Shields again, another interview, but this time 35 years later.
I wrote an obituary, and then I was very much misrepresented. When the obituary came out, it actually was nothing that I had written.
What do you hear here that's of interest?
Well, the thing about Brooke Shields is that while her voice, her tone, you know, the vocal register has gone down a little bit, a lot of the features of her accent have stayed remarkably stable. She's talking about, say, represented obituary. If you take somebody who is at the age now that Brooke Shields was back in the 1980s, such as Abigail Breslin, you would hear something more like obituary and represented. The vowels are shifting downwards, but it's an intergenerational thing. It's subtle. And the interesting thing is that Brooke Shields is largely keeping the accent that she had when she was about 18, which is very common for people to do. Once they lock in at a certain point, the rest is usually tinkering unless you make a major geographic or social set change, and then you're making a conscious effort.
I've been speaking with language expert James Harbeck. Thank you so much, James.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, but we would love to hear your accent. Are you a Georgian native? Do you have an accent? Call us and let us hear it. The number is 404-500-9457. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day, y'all.